So last year, how excited are we on a scale of one to extremely?
Yeah, extremely. 70 billion, extremely. It is absolutely buzzing in here already, and we're only just getting started. There's so many big stands up. There's so much food out. There's a lot of drinks out as well. I was quite surprised by that. So yeah, definitely hyped. How are you feeling?
Yeah, it's good. The stand has really come together. We're here in our little booth. Actually, it's a bit bigger than we thought, actually. We've got all the mics set up. All the kit seems to be working. So we are super excited to start welcoming some of our interviewees sort of fairly soon, really. And have you checked out any of the other stands yet? Seen their merch and stuff?
I've had a good walk around. Lots of good merch. Lots of coffee. I think we're all going to be absolutely buzzing by the end of the day. But yeah, lots of good stuff and lots of interesting designs of the stands too. Definitely a step up from what I had in mind. So
yeah, I saw some fluffy dogs on the merch front, which I think could be my winner to take him back home for the little ones. It could be quite good. That last year's winner was definitely the fluffy goats. I'm not sure I've seen them again, but fluffy dogs are pretty good.
Yeah, I feel like that one's very much aimed at the parenting population, which I am not part of.
Any special prep you've done today? Sort of gargling with locally sourced honey, green tea sort of vibe?
Yeah, I mean, just the usual stuff, you know, power posing in front of the mirror, listening to Beyonce, of course.
Love it, of course.
Getting myself excited and probably just reading the program a lot and reminding myself what's going on and trying to make sure I'm going to have time to do everything and see everything I want to, but still like sleep and rest and all of that.
Yeah, channeling those Beyonce vibes is always the way forward, isn't it? Yeah, so I mean, obviously being away from home and away from my wonderful two kids, I had a rather more leisurely morning than I usually would. So I managed to have super long lie-in and do a gym session and have a lovely long breakfast and still be in here nice and early. So that was my prep.
Amazing. Imagine that's what life's like every day for me. No kids.
Welcome to Investment Uncut, live from the PLSA Investment Conference 2023 in Edinburgh.
Investment Uncut is LCP's podcast all about investing. And this episode is one of a special mini-series recorded in our podcast booth, straight from the conference exhibition hall.
In this mini-series, we bring you interviews with some of the big-name conference speakers, authors, CIOs, and investors.
We ask what's currently most on their mind, what they're watching out for, and what big ideas they're taking away from this year's conference.
We also review each day's presentations, bringing in our own thoughts on the conference, summarizing content, and aiming to capture the vibe.
And we ask the really important questions like, who has the best conference merch?
We hope you enjoy. And if you like these episodes, please recommend and share with a colleague or contact.
And you can also check out our posts on LinkedIn.
Great. So just before we welcome our first interview guest, we're going to just recap on a couple of things, weren't we? First things first, pretty exciting day for you yesterday, right? Do you want to run us through what happened?
Yeah, it was really cool. So I actually got to meet Laura Trott, who's our current pensions minister, not the cyclist. And that was really, really cool. I haven't really met any politicians before, apart from our own, you know, Steve Webb, who used to be the pensions minister. But it was really cool to meet her. She had really amazing energy. She seemed very passionate about pensions and the inequality that exists there. And the session that we went to see her about was all about the gender pension gap results that the government released that day. So, I mean, unsurprisingly, there is a gender pension gap. It's around, I think, 34% overall. It's bigger in DC than DB. And there's, as always, still a very big gap just between the pension outcomes for DC and DB members. So they ran a really interesting sort of discussion session where Steve Webb from LCP, as former pensions minister, interviewed Laura. They had a bit of a discussion. There was questions from the audience. And it was really good just to see her kind of out and about and, you know, listening to what the industry wants. So yeah, it was a very cool experience and quite different to anything I've done before.
Yeah, that's really cool. So that's high on her agenda, is it then? Gender pensions gap is a big deal, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah cool. That's great that you met the pensions minister. That's kind of like celeb sort of status here, isn't
it? She really did give off celebrity vibes. I don't know what it was, but just as soon as I walked into the room, she just had this amazing like presence. And yeah, it was like a celebrity, honestly.
Cool. Okay, well, let's turn back to the PLSA conference then. So we were doing a bit of digging back, weren't we, last year. I was looking for the posts I put out on LinkedIn for some of the sort of key takeaways from last year's conference. I think there was one that you found particularly amusing. So go on, what was that?
There are a couple. I think there was one we were talking about returning to the office, which obviously would have been a big talk of conversation last year. And I think the comment was about senior people only wanting people to come into the office so that they'll laugh at their jokes. And it was a bit too real. I definitely recognize that.
Yeah, there's certain elements of that, isn't it? Yeah, I don't know whether the back to office sort of discussion has moved on that much. It feels like it probably isn't so much of a talking point now, sort of settled down, but it's not. I think it was Christine Armstrong who said that, actually. She's a good follow on LinkedIn, talks a lot about future of work and stuff, but I don't know that there's been some huge kind of reimagining of it. It's just sort of plodded along, hasn't it, and evolved.
Exactly. Really. And then you have events like this that kind of remind everyone what the benefits are of being back together in person. Yeah. Is, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And there was another point, was it Robert Pearson last year? Someone threw out, it might have been Adam Bolton, threw out a crazy, what seemed then a crazy prediction that there would be a new prime minister before the next election. That was May 2022. Of course, Boris Johnson was prime minister at the time still. So that prediction was pretty good. If anything, not quite bold enough.
I know.
Been a couple, haven't there? I can't quite remember, what is it, two or three? You've gone through a few chancellors as well since then.
It depends if you count the letters or not.
Yeah, that was another good prediction. What else were we talking about? Yeah, so there was lots talking about inflation, obviously, last year. That also seemed pretty spot on. Oh yeah, there was this idea that we're sort of at the hinge of history, which is probably just people getting fed up of using the word pivot, I think, or kind of like turning point. But yeah, this idea that there were short-term themes that were becoming medium-term things. And by that, I think it was sort of COVID, basically, and you know, the Russian invasion of Ukraine were sort of immediate issues, but are also going to be kind of medium-term.
I mean, how much were people talking about or perhaps anticipating the cost of living situation we'd be in now? Was that something that came up last year?
I don't remember it being that much. I mean, I don't know what inflation was doing then. I guess it continued to surprise people. I don't remember that being a massive thing last year. I really don't. Not sure. But yeah, that's been obviously a huge thing, hasn't it? Yeah.
And what do you think are going to be the biggest themes that we see this year? Or what do you want to see?
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of talk about inflation. They're talking about interest rates, I imagine. I suspect there'll be a little bit about geopolitics, you know, fragmentation kind of thing. So yeah, there's plenty of themes you can sort of latch onto. I remember one comment last year, I think, was that people sort of remember semi-fondly back to the days when Brexit was the biggest risk anyone could come up with, you know, globally to asset markets, which we've kind of moved quite far on from that and not necessarily in good ways. Right?
Oh, for simpler times.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. All right. Well, should we leave it there and get on with our interviews then?
Let's do it. So we're now in our podcast booth at the PLSA, about to record our very first interview. So we're super excited. And we've got John Chilman, who is the CEO of Railpen with us, which is one of the biggest asset owners in the country.
John, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Great to be back in Edinburgh.
Yeah, it's great to see you here. Everyone seems to be happy. The vibe's picking up. And yeah, we're looking for a good conference, aren't we? It should be brilliant.
I hope so. Yes, it's nice to be back in person for the second year in a row and really looking forward to some good content today as well.
Yeah, brilliant. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about your role just quickly, just give people a bit of perspective?
Yes, so I'm the CEO of Railpen, and Railpen is the sort of executive of the Railways Pension Scheme. So I look after the business, making sure we've got the right resources in place for both investment and management, for fiduciary advice to our schemes and trustees, and also the administration. So we do just about everything apart from the actuarial valuation in-house. And we also do third-party admin as well. So we've got a responsibility there. So really, I'm about resources, making sure that we've got the right staff, the right talent, and trying to run an effective business that maintains the investment returns in particular that we need to do to keep the scheme going, because unlike many, we are still an open DB scheme.
Yeah, of course. And you are chair on the PLSA policy board as well, of course. So you've got various roles over the course of the next few days, chairing panel sessions, this, that and the other.
Absolutely. Yeah, I have a few non-exec roles. You get to a certain age and actually you think you need to start giving something back to the industry as well. So I do the PLSA role and I also sit on the board of the Pensions Policy Institute. So two really worthwhile causes.
Wow. So you must be a pretty busy man.
Yeah, that's why I look like this.
That is definitely not how I meant it. And we love a bit of a fun fact on this podcast. So can you tell us something that we wouldn't find on your CV?
So what you wouldn't see is that for all my formative years, I was really passionate about music. So I learned to play 5 different instruments and spent most of my years, probably up to the age of about 18, playing in bands, groups, orchestras, choirs of various descriptions, right from classical orchestras into playing drums in a heavy rock band. So that was my passion. And until 17, that was what I wanted my career to be.
Wow. So from a rock star to pensions, I mean, is there that much of a difference?
I think I've probably been more successful in pensions than I would have been as a rock star, to be honest. The opportunities there are few and far between, and you've got to be really good, and I was never that good.
Yeah, it feels like a safer bet career-wise, doesn't it? But you can be the rock star of pensions for today, don't worry about it, it's fine. So, okay, turning to matters at hand, we're expecting to hear a lot about relevant issues at the moment, what people are worrying about, what people are thinking about. So why don't you give us some thoughts about some of the things that are on your mind right now as in your role as CEO at Railpen?
Well, when I look forward, I mean, there's some outstanding business being done at the moment. I think the DB funding code is something that we are incredibly interested in because it really will affect the way that we can invest going forward. that's vital for us because we've been quite heavily growth on as an open plan. We really need to keep that to allow our scheme to flourish and to continue. So interested to see what comes out of that and from the DWP consultation on the regs. It's been late, it's been slow. Let's hope it's good when it comes out. And of course, we just look at the environment we're in today, and that's a really challenging one. And so it's how we get those returns that we want. We see the stock market falling back a little bit. That doesn't cause us too much pain because we've been lucky and locked in many of the gains that have come through in the last couple of years, particularly the Liz Truss quasi-Kwarteng budget that meant actually our funding position went up incredibly well during that time.
Yeah, it was definitely a strange time, wasn't it?
Yeah, they're strange times, but I think this is when you work out whether your governance is good enough. If you have great governance, you can adapt to that, you can flex, you can do the things you need to lock in those positions. And we were very lucky to do that, having not had any LDI exposure at the start of that crisis. So really quite unusual as a pension plan to be in that position.
Wow, that's very unusual. And I think you're absolutely right. It's something that has been quite underappreciated, how important it is to have that good governance in place. I mean, is there anything else you think is pretty underappreciated in the world of pensions and investing?
I think people look at pensions and investing and say it must be easy. You just put it here and you leave it there for a long time. I think that may have been the case once, but I think increasingly more dynamism, more sort of bespoke strategies are required. And that's difficult. That does require governance. That does require a trustee that can either get its head around it or delegate to some sort of fiduciary model that allows that to be successful. So I think it's very difficult. And as we approach, for a lot of DB schemes, which is where I'm involved, the end game, you need precision that much of the time you haven't needed. You've only needed to be approximately in the right direction, but now precision is everything. So I think that's an underappreciated skill, and we'll start seeing that in its sort of real glory coming through. And for us, that's so important because when people say Rails Pension Scheme, they just think, oh, it's a scheme. Actually, it's 106 schemes wrapped up in something called the Railways Pension Scheme. So we actually have 106 different investment strategies for our sections. And that's a complexity that people don't necessarily appreciate.
And I mean, this might be an obvious or stupid question, but why do you have 106 schemes? How come you don't just have them all in one?
If only that was possible. It's because of the way the sponsorship works. So at privatisation, we had 6 sections. But as we had what was called a protected position, so we had protected members, if they left that employer and joined somebody else that would have been in the rail, they had to stay in the rail scheme. They couldn't stay in the previous section, so new sections were established. And as British Rail, in terms of running the trains around the organising around the country, were moved on to be split up, each of those took a section, and it has carried on multiplying like that. It's quite painful, it's quite difficult, and each of those sections negotiates its own benefits, which is why we have 1,000 different benefit designs as well.
Wow, yeah, there's definitely some complexity there, yeah. I mean, you talk about DB Endgame, and I'm guessing there's going to be quite a big theme on that over the next few days over the conference. There's quite a few sessions that seem to be sort of the future of DB, the future DB landscape, you know, the future considerations for DB. There's quite a few sessions on that, but I guess it is a relevant consideration at this moment. I mean, it's a bit of a cliche to say we're at a tipping point, pivot point, whatever you want to call it, but it's kind of true, isn't it, I guess?
It is. I mean, I think we've got the accelerated view because we sat there with some of our closed sections and said, we've got a 15 to 20 year time horizon. Now it's a 5 to 10 years. So trustees really need to get their head around this soon. Now, what is their end game solution? Are they happy to run off? Have they got the scale to do that? Does that make sense? And to be honest, I think even if you do that, at some point, the buyout becomes the right thing to do because scale always gets too small. Or is it an earlier exit? And some of this is driven by the corporates, as we know, because not having that liability on your balance sheet is very valuable for many corporates.
Yeah, great. Pivoting slightly, the risk of using a cliche, maybe thinking a bit broader. I love asking people, what are some of the big trends that you would look back on over the last 10 years, maybe of your whole career sort of thing that you think we're seeing play out or have played out?
Well, it's interesting because when I started, pension schemes largely invested in the UK. And we've seen that globalization. And now we're seeing a bit of noise around, actually, should they be investing more in the UK? I think we still are quite heavily invested in the UK overall. But obviously, to fund some of those sort of growth type assets would be really quite important. And from a DB point of view, the end game, that doesn't really resonate too well with that. But for DC, LGPS, those with a much longer time horizon, it does make some sense to do that. So I think that's one of the things that's changed. When I started, LDI didn't exist. Before the days of Rob and Dawid and people like that, it was an unknown quantity. While it had its travail last year, I think those with good governance came through it well. It's here to stay. It makes sense. Those are two of the big themes I've seen that I think are very important. And when we started in 1994, we had I think it was 6 balanced funds as our managers. And obviously now it's a very, very more specialist boutique type model underneath. And indeed, we do a lot of the management ourselves. So there's been a massive amount of changes, which you have to look back and say, has it helped? Hopefully, yes. Has it made it much more complicated for trustees to do the job well? Undoubtedly. So going back to that governance point, that for me is a major player in terms of moving forward, in terms of saying, how do you get the skill set right for people to come in, act as trustees, which is an incredibly responsible thing, but it's a really hard job to do.
Do you think any of those changes actually we'd be better off if they hadn't happened, or were they all for the best?
Look, I think overall, one of the things I've talked about there, we're all for the best. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't you try and find the best company globally? Why wouldn't you try and match out your liabilities so you're not subject to the vagaries of these mark-to-market calculations, which probably as an accountant, I can say is probably the worst thing that came along. It's made life very difficult and has actually led to the demise of many DB schemes because it's just become an unacceptable risk on your balance sheet.
The point about investing in the UK, it's a really relevant one, isn't it, at the moment? It's a huge debate. Yeah, it was all over the news, but I feel there are quite a few sessions at the conference, actually, that might sort of get at that question. There's a few politicians speaking. I mean, as a sort of big asset owner, do you feel a bit of pressure? Do you push back against that pressure? Are you sort of leaning into it?
Well, when I look at where we invest, I can justifiably say we've got wind farms, we've got biomass plants, we've got solar farms, we've got all these things that are our UK infrastructure investment. The struggle we have, if it's about sort of scaling up some of the venture, that's probably not something where there's been the products to invest in the UK. We've got plenty of that. We've got lots of illiquids, but not necessarily bundled in the way that makes it easy for UK investors to access. And I think that's something that we'd need to work on if this was to work. So I'm not scared about it. And when we talk about it from a DC point of view, where you look at the PPI research around does having illiquids and alternatives in DC improve your member outcome? Yes, it does. So it makes a lot of sense to try and put that in there if you can find a way to make it work. And it's non-trivial, that.
Definitely. And I guess the scale of DC is a lot smaller than DB. So perhaps there's less ability to, you know, get that growth for the UK in DC.
Well, it is smaller today. But I think what we see is that what DC is about $500 billion at the moment, it'll go to $1 billion in about the next 6 or 7 years. The scale is improving rapidly. And if we do get some of the movements with more people coming into AE, higher contribution levels, I would expect that number to get there. DB's fairly consistent about 1.4, 1.5 trillion. So that's not going up.
No, I mean, I guess if anything, you'd expect it to go down as more people stop having DB pensions.
Yeah, I think that's inevitable. And as we see that transfer into this consolidation model, which is another theme of today, really, in the current environment.
Yeah. And I wonder if, I guess you're also in a bit of a different position, one as a very large asset owner, but also because you're still an open scheme. So not many other schemes maybe are able to have as much in the illiquids, the infrastructure, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. We're lucky that our open sections, largely train operators, network rail, people like that, are going to be around for a long time. We can take a very long-term view. And particularly if you're looking at the different scales on private markets between the sort of private debt, which is a relatively short period through the buyout, when you're looking at venture, that's a very long-term commitment. And even we look at that and say, wow, we know we've got money in the ground that hasn't come out from 1990s type investments.
Really? Yeah. Yeah, that always makes me wonder. I'm not so sure that UK venture as an asset class is something that's sort of institutionally viable right now. I don't know. A lot of that stuff tends to be global or US focused, doesn't it, when you actually look at funds?
It does. Inevitably, the funds are US and we'd have to create something. I mean, the thing is, there's great universities in the UK and there's great spin outs, but the investment doesn't come from UK pension funds and we don't have a sovereign wealth fund and we don't have many high net worth individuals that invest in this sort of way.
So should we talk a bit about the conference itself? And what are you looking forward to the most about this year's conference?
Well, to be honest, I always like to hear the politicians. As much as what they don't say is what they do say, because they have to be very careful about what's going on. But I'm particularly looking forward to the last two sessions. Ed Balls, as an ex-politician, usually means that the gloves are off. He can say a bit more what he wants. And obviously, Robert Peston has a very interesting take on these things. So I think many of the technical things I've probably come across in the past. If I haven't, I want to know why. But it's really getting that bit of insight. I'm going to go back to, was it last year when we had Nick Robinson? And it was the only time we had an audible gasp in the hall when he made one of his comments.
Really? Do you remember what the gasp was for?
It was that Priti Patel could be the next prime minister.
Yeah, that obviously didn't prove to be true. But obviously, he was also predicting a new prime minister before the next election, which we were just saying a second ago actually has obviously been a pretty good prediction, and in fact wasn't quite bold enough. But yeah, I was wondering who that was. Well, yeah, we'll see what they've got for us this year in terms of that. What do you think about Edinburgh in June? Anything underappreciated about Edinburgh that you don't like about
it? I used to live in Edinburgh. So oh, one, I oh, think right. it's a fantastic right. city.
Oh, you're local then. You're not one of these tourists. You sort of just come in for the...
Yeah, I know enough about Edinburgh. What I would say is Edinburgh has a lot of underappreciated things that people don't go and see. They go and see the castle, they go into various things, they go and see Britannia out at Leith. But wandering around Edinburgh is really quite interesting. Mary Queen's Close, things like that, Mary Queen's Close. What I'd say is Edinburgh also has a dark side. So some of the ghost stories going underneath the old town, really interesting. But I always sort of look at the comment that's made by the Glaswegians about Edinburgh, that Edinburgh is all fur coat and no knickers.
Okay, yeah, that is.
I feel like that one needs a lot of untangling. Yeah,
quote of the day.
And so this is my first time coming to the PLSA conference. I'm a newbie to it. Do you mind me asking how many times you've been before?
Let's say I think the first time I came was in 2000.
Okay, I won't tell you how old I was then.
But no, it's a great opportunity. And actually, as you'll recognise, part of this is actually getting people to talk to each other. So many of our meetings now, even trustee ones, are virtual. That's you don't true. Get the time to actually socialise and find out what your peers are doing. Because I found that pensions people are more than happy to share what's going on and their experiences and help you. So I'd encourage people to go and talk to somebody they don't know as opposed to somebody they do.
Okay, was that your main piece of advice for me then, do you reckon?
Yeah.
I'll definitely take that one away.
I don't think you'll have a problem with that.
Thank you, I think.
Great. Okay. Well, John, this has been a fantastic conversation. Have a great conference. And thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, we can't wait to hear both of your talks.
Well, fortunately, I'm moderating on most of them, so I'm only curating. But thank you for inviting me. And yeah, hope you have a great time and all the attendees do as well.
Excellent. Thanks.
Cheers, John.
Thank you.
So just quickly before we do the intro here last year, I got to say, we're talking about merch. I have just had a picture of my face stenciled into the top of a coffee, which I think is pretty good on the merch front, right?
It was very high tech. I have to say, it was a little bit creepy, like how high definition it was. But yeah, I'm quite impressed. I'm quite impressed with it. Did it taste good? Did your face taste good?
Yeah, it was fine. It was fine. It was coffee. It was good.
Brilliant.
Just about to get that out there.
Just too excited. Couldn't keep it in any longer. Well, we're really excited now. We're joined for our next interview with Stelios Soloustros, who is the head of investments at the Barclay UK Retirement Fund. So we're so excited to have you here. Welcome.
Hi. I'm very happy to be here and thanks for having me.
Stelios, can you tell us a couple of words about your role, maybe, just to sort of fill people in?
Yeah. So I've been in my current role for the last 12.5 years. I head the investment team for the Barclays UK Retirement Fund. So what we do is just simply use all our discretion, use the discretion that the trustees have provided to us to essentially monitor the assets for the fund.
Brilliant. And we also like to get a bit of a fun fact. So can you tell us something that we maybe wouldn't find on your CV about you?
Fun fact. I mean, it was not that fun. So very early in my career, and I know you said it wouldn't be on your CV, but actually it's not. Very early in my career, I did take a very long sabbatical because I had to join the Greek army because I had to do my compulsory service.
Right.
So I did 14 months there. Having said that, half of it was in roads from April to October.
Well, that
so
sounds pretty pleasant.
It was an absolutely brilliant, brilliant time. So I had a great time for 14 months and then I came straight back in to working.
Oh, what was your role within the army?
It was very plain simple. I did join very late. I was a little bit on the older side. So I did do some admin work, which was very helpful for me. But at the same time, you know, the army is all about being flat. It's all about just bringing your ego down. Just everyone is being treated exactly the same. So I was just doing exactly what everyone else was doing. Just guarding places, just exercise training and so on.
I'm sure it must give you some really interesting perspectives, actually, coming back to work after doing that.
It does. I mean, before you started, you feel it's the biggest absolute waste of time, that time, especially at that time in your life when you're just coming out of university, you really want to go into work. I had started working already for 1.5 years, but I have to go and do this. So at that point, you feel quite frustrated and angry. But I think once you get into it, once you see what you can get out, and once you, a few years later, you actually say that we will all have enough years in front of us to work, I think it was one of the best things I've ever done.
Yeah, interesting. Cool. All right, well, pivoting off a little bit, we've We just come out of the Danny Blanchflower session. We can talk about a little bit about that maybe. He certainly thinks that policymakers have the labour markets all wrong and that they should be cutting rather than hiking. But I mean, maybe before we get that, maybe we can take a little bit of a step back. I mean, there's going to be a lot of talk, I'm sure, today, what's on people's radar, what's on people's minds, what are they sort of looking out for. So go on then, what's forefront of your mind right now as you sort of look at the markets and investments and things?
Yeah, I mean, I have said the PLSA is doing quite a good job. Just when I heard your pod, I think your last pod, when essentially, you know, trying to find out what is in people's minds. And if you just take a cursory look on the agenda, you can actually say, you know, it's all about liquidity, liability management, and, you know, liquidity related to that. DC plays a huge role in there. From a more macro perspective, clearly, you know, inflation and growth and interest rates and where this combination is actually going. So I wouldn't say I'm much further away than those items. They are pretty much the ones that I think people are absolutely hitting the point here in the agenda for the PLSA.
No, that's good. I mean, it shows that they've been doing their research properly and listening to their survey feedback, isn't it?
I think they are. I mean, it's a very difficult period at the moment. I know. It's one of those things that ex-post, everything always looks very straightforward, right? You can just look back, you can just look all the data. The revisions are already there. You've seen exactly what has happened. And when you look back, everything looks quite straightforward ex post. Ex ante, I always find it much more complex. I always find it much more difficult. The narrative is always different. And I think, you know, in the current situation, I find it very, very interesting that, you know, in some way, I think there's a consensus that the consensus is wrong.
which I haven't seen
for a very, very long time. Like, everyone is saying that, you know, the markets are wrong, or either the equity markets are wrong or the bond markets are wrong. And there's that consensus just going on and on and on. And, you know, yes, controversial views going on, but then you also need to look about how long those views are going on for, and therefore whether you can afford or you can survive what the market is throwing at you in the meantime.
That is a brilliant way of putting it, actually, because that is exactly what it is. But of course, that can't be right. It can't be the consensus is wrong, but somehow you often feel like that. And I guess there's people you're hearing from or whatever it is, people sort of railing against the consensus, but you hear it so many times, it becomes a bit like, yeah, it
exactly.
becomes the narrative.
And then because you don't see the price in the markets, you're like, something must be going on. And going back a couple of years, everyone was so transfixed in that transitory inflation, but everyone was absolutely right, yeah? It will be transitory, and if you don't define how far high is going to go, and if you don't define the time period that is going to stay above targets, of course it's going to be transitory. And I think Professor was absolutely right that, you know, base effects will work and one-off effects will always drop off after a period of time. The bit which is much more difficult, I think, for central banks clearly and for people who need to make the decisions is they need to assess how long this is going to go on for. And they also need to assess, you know, if it's a growth, how deep the growth reduction is going to be, or how high the inflation is going to go. Because if you can't survive that episode for that period of time at this height, then, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're absolutely convinced that this is transitory and it's going to go away. You have to act on that. I mean, Just another example there is clearly what we do, you know, when you manage an investment portfolio, you want to do exactly the same thing on, you know, equity corrections. You can't just sit there thinking equities will come back. They always do.
Yeah. So how is this sort of strange environment that we're in affecting the way that you're thinking about your investment portfolio for the Barclays Fund?
For me, it's absolutely going back to your strategic underpin and then having that underpin in place, whatever the strategy, the trustee goals, if you manage a pension fund or an endowment, expectations in terms of, you know, paying yield out, whatever that strategic underpin is, you absolutely need to go back to exactly what you want to do and what is the exact target of that portfolio. And once you have that strategic underpin, then everything you do clearly can be adjusted, right, depending on where the market is, on a more dynamic, if you like, perspective. So listen, from a pension fund perspective, we're not all of a sudden, you know very well what the trends have been over the last several years. It is one of ongoing de-risking, and we see that in markets, we see that in pension funds, we see that in all portfolios. And of course, if that is the strategic underpin, this is essentially where the path is going to stay. However, what you want to do is perhaps be a little bit more dynamic, a little bit more protective of the portfolio on the downside. And absolutely, for me, the most important thing, and clearly September, October was, you know, clearly saw that, was very simply the importance of managing liquidity in absolutely prudent and right way for a multi-asset fund.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps we get on to that. I mean, I'm still fascinated by your point about the consensus. And I guess just extending your sort of strategic thoughts there about investing, I guess part of it is just understanding if you do want to be different to the consensus. A lot of the time it's fun to debate the consensus, isn't it? Is the consensus wrong or right? But what often isn't said enough, I think, is that most of the time, investing with the consensus, as in just owning equities, owning corporate bonds, is what people do. And actually moving away from it is something you have to do, you know, really carefully, really a little bit at a time. Even though we spend a lot of time debating what those little things could be and where the consensus could be wrong, it's a little bit imbalanced, that always fine.
You're right. And I think you can do that departure in pockets of the portfolio. But if you manage a large portfolio, a large multi-asset fund, it is a much bigger ask. And I think you need, you know, very, very significant conviction, but also your strategic goals to allow for that, to be able to essentially shift the portfolio as significantly as, you know, views like this. I mean, this year has been quite tough, right? Everyone walked into the year being long financials, loving commodities because, you know, inflation will absolutely do that. Equities, everyone, you know, it has been a pain trade because people were expecting them to go down quite a bit. And all of a sudden, everyone is just keep pushing expectations further out. The chart that Professor showed earlier on about the growth expectations, it was absolutely brilliant, right? You know, you have that just shifting. Every month is shifting a few more months. Interest rate expectations exactly the same way. So, yeah, I mean, debating the consensus and trying to understand where you stand against it is clearly, for an investor like us, for a pension fund investor, is absolutely the key, because then it allows you to position a little bit one way or the other. But it will, I have to say, it will never be black and white compared to where your strategy is. You will have to always stay with your strategic underpin, always stay with your number one goal, which is to pay the pensions, pay the members, and make sure you can stay the course.
And do you think this position we're in now, kind of nobody agreeing with the consensus or so many different views, do you think that that's something that will persist? Is that the new normal now, or will we go back to a more perhaps stable, predictable, you know, way of thinking as a market?
I mean, we've gone through a very, very unique period over the last 15, 20 years, haven't we? And all of a sudden, we saw this incredible readjustment of rates that we saw last year. So I think everyone's expectation is that, because stopping that and going a step back, everyone would always find it very difficult to see how we're going to get out of this very low interest rates. I remember myself for the last 15 years, all the discussions, how are we going to get out of this from 2008, 2009, 10? What is going on? Are we ever going to see positive real rates again? And then all of a sudden, within 12 months, it was all done. So I think the expectation is that, yes, we are going to go into a more reasonable boom-bust cycle with businesses essentially just going through the cycle alongside with seeing defaults essentially coming at the right levels and perhaps some of those defaults being allowed to happen. I think it was interesting what also the professor said earlier on about the fact that, you know, we have to also make very difficult choices for once in terms of, you know, if we want lower inflation, then there needs to be some pain somewhere. I love the point about people prefer inflation to growth from some question or survey. I'm a little bit surprised by that, especially given the fact that people haven't seen inflation for 30 years, right? Perhaps that's the reason why, because, you know, we haven't seen really bad inflation, persistent inflation at very high levels.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because we always think that growth is a good thing. It must be good for the UK. But does the average person in the UK actually benefit from growth? Or are they feeling it, you know, in their own happiness or in their own pockets as much as, say, unemployment?
That's a brilliant point. It's a brilliant point. I have discussed it quite a lot with a lot of other people I have worked with in terms of essentially how do you measure that growth success? Is it GDP? Is it GDP per head? Is it some other measure? It's a super point. I don't know if you want to go into this right now.
I love this stuff. You know, it's like there's happiness indices, social progress indices, that sort of stuff. I'm absolutely here for that all day long.
Well, but, it's quite new to me, to be honest, until we heard the talk today where he was talking about, you know, how unemployment versus inflation impacts happiness. It's not something I'm really familiar with.
I'm glad he said that, actually, because he's right. The trade-off obviously is between inflation and recession and unemployment, exactly that. And often, for some reason, the tone is very much focused on inflation and people whose jobs are very secure sort of banging the table and saying, oh, we must bring down inflation sort of thing. It's like, well, it's very well saying that if you've got a very secure job, obviously, but it's not recognizing the trade-off on the other side. And I think, yeah, the point that Professor Blanchflower was making is that that is a real trade-off. Not enough time is put into understanding it, I think, is what he was saying, more than he had a sort of answer to it, right? But I'm glad he said that, because it does seem to go missing in the central bank narrative a lot of the time. But they have a tough job, don't they? I guess central bankers. Easy to sit here and bash them. I don't have a lot of time for people who sit here and bash central bankers, because it's a bit easy, isn't it, really? It's cop-out.
It is a very tough job. I mean, the other thing which is very difficult for them is it's quite clearly the perception which they can absolutely cannot lose, you know, the market's trust. I know Professor said that market has lost trust in them, but at the same time, you know, if we make the assumption this is true, what if they had lost faith in them being able to fight inflation? You could potentially end up with, you know, much more negative results and consequences of going down that road. So it is something that is right there in their minds, and I can absolutely see where they're coming from.
Yeah.
Whether I agree or not, or clearly the professor doesn't, I'd probably be a little bit more neutral on that.
I do feel like we could do a whole episode just talking about some of these dynamics.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost a parlor game, isn't it? Like debating what central banks should and shouldn't do. And I kind of feel it's not always the right question. The better question is like, how are they actually going to respond in real life to something? And yeah, that's often the bigger question. Before we start sort of wrapping up, whatever, I want to get back to another question you alluded to, Stereos, which is the question of illiquidity and managing that. Any sort of reflections on kind of high-level principles for how that sort of what works basically on that?
I genuinely believe one of the most difficult tasks you have within a multi-asset portfolio, if you oversee a multi-asset portfolio, is managing cash and liquidity across the portfolio. If you're just managing, let's say, an equity portfolio with a bit of operational cash or anything else, I think it's all plain simple, it's all fine. But once you get into multi-assets, once you get into that, having pockets of cash and liquidity pretty much everywhere, once you get into having and needing collateral at various places in the fund, like now or yesterday, and therefore you need to absolutely take that into account, and you need to balance that with that massive eagerness to always have the best manager and the best investment in absolutely everything we have, which is great, right? This is why we're here. But it does increase complexity. So you do have quite forces, cross currents essentially happening there. So for me, it is, first of all, you need to think about liquidity in all sorts of different ways. So in terms of timing, so, you know, short-term liquidity, you know, days to a few months to a few quarters. And then you also need to, so I think about this horizontally. When I think across time, do I have the liquidity in different periods of time? You know, you go back to CDI and everything else. But I also think it's very important to also think about that vertically down the portfolio as well. Because if you just think about, do I have enough cash? Then quite clearly that will absolutely work until you start hitting perhaps some pain points, until you start hitting a situation like September, October last year. So unless you also think about the individual assets and what is your liquidity budget, and your liquidity management of those assets all down to the portfolio, then this is a bit that I think sometimes is possibly missing.
What you're saying is not just about what liquidity you're holding today, it's about the playbook that you would follow in terms of what could be liquid and under what scenarios over what lead times in the future. It's
correct.
Not just today,
I couldn't help with it better than that.
Yeah.
So it's exactly right. So, I mean, I think most people are just focusing on, do I have enough money to pay pensions or to pay anything I need or finance X, Y, Z in the next, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 months? Yes, great. Okay, if I run out of cash, what can I do? Yeah, you have some liquid assets here, but perhaps they don't go into mapping the whole portfolio into, okay, so what is the potential liquidation profile of this portfolio naturally, but also if I nudge it or if I perhaps force it, and if I do force it, what do I need to pay for that? So it is incredibly important, and you know, within any portfolios we are looking to manage, we are absolutely trying to create, once we understand and we assess that illiquidity of the assets, we're trying to create the conditions within the portfolio for those assets to do what they're supposed to do. I'm not going to sit here and tell you illiquidity is all you need, right, is you can't go wrong with the liquidity. Of course, you can go wrong. And of course, you know, you may not get the returns you want. But if you have done all the work that you need to do, if you've done your due diligence, accessing the assets, you just want to let the assets do their job. So from my perspective, I think, you know, having a proper liquidity management framework to not have to bother those assets, having appropriate downside protection in the portfolio, which will bring you liquidity exactly when you need it, is probably the two tools that should be used a little bit more. Because I think quality in the portfolio is great. Everyone tries to buy the best quality assets. And also, everyone is trying to diversify. And that is absolutely right. Any asset you buy, by definition, is a diversifier. It's not 100% correlated. But the liquidity management, I get enough liquidity in there to let the assets do their job, and then having pockets that you expect to really flourish when things start getting really tight, so downside protection. And if I need to pay a little bit, if the portfolio needs to pay a little bit for it in terms of expected return, then that's what you need to pay.
No, I think that's so true. Now we're all realizing we need to have these policies in mind. We need to understand liquidity, so important at the moment. So I do want to just ask you a few questions about the conference itself, because this is my first time going to the conference, this PLSA conference. Have you got any advice for me? Anything that you think is the best thing about the conference that I should look out for?
The conference itself, I mean, it's a brilliant place to be. There are so many people, close to 1,000, I think, every year. You also have so much diversity in terms of different agents within that, the chain or the investment chain, right? You have consultants, you have managers, you have investment advisors, you have pretty much every interesting job and profession around. So what I find very interesting about the PLSA is that by doing that work of trying to understand what people have in their minds, they just raise the right questions. They never give the right answers at the conference, because that's not, I think, what the conference should be about. But it's all about raising those questions, debating them, and then just let people go away, do their homework, do a little bit more thinking, speak to each other and try to solve those problems. So from that perspective, you know, my advice about the conference to you was just use the opportunity to be able to speak to so many different people from so many different companies, all being at the same place, and just have those fireside chats and then catch up with them back in London or wherever else you can catch up with them after that.
Brilliant. I'll definitely take that.
But there's a good framework, isn't there? Trying to think about what the big questions are. I think that is a good start, even if you can't answer them. And it's interesting because even just a couple of sessions in, I think that it's starting to get a sense of what some of those are. Just quickly before we wind up, any recommendations for good series, books or podcasts that you want to shout out? What are you into at the moment now that Succession has finished anyway?
Gosh, so I don't watch series on the telly. I watch a huge amount of football and a huge amount of sports, but I don't do that. But podcast-wise, I do listen quite a bit. If you are a football fan, then I would definitely go for the Guardian Football Weekly. It's an absolute gem. Really funny, really good.
Is this a bit we should ask? Should we ask who you support or not? Because it's the time of year when there's going to be issues.
Yeah, well, I was hoping you're not going to ask. But yeah, okay. I'm a Chelsea fan. However, right, from next year, I'm going to be more focused on my Greek team, AEK Athens. So there you go.
AEK Athens. Hot tip for next year. Are they?
They are in Champions League.
They're in Champions League. Oh, wow. Okay.
Given that Chelsea's not, that's my focus for next year.
Wow. Oh, great. Okay.
Excellent.
The only other podcast which I really enjoy listening to is The Stories of Our Times.
Oh, I love
really,
that one.
Really, really clever story. Really interesting stories. Really going deep. Very investigative. Very, very good investigators around very important topics.
Totally agree. Brilliant. Well, it was great having you on here today, and I look forward to seeing you over the rest of the conference and hope you enjoy it.
Thanks very much for having me. Yeah, it was brilliant. Thank you. Enjoyed it a lot.
Thank
you. So much for your time.
Thanks.
Cool.
So we've just come straight out of the CIO's panel, and we're really excited to be joined by one of the panelists, Richard Tomlinson, who is the CIO of LPP, the Local Pensions Partnership. We actually haven't had anybody on here yet from the sort of local government pension scheme side. So we're really excited to get into sort of drilling into Richard's thoughts on everything we've been discussing. Welcome, Richard. Great to have you
Hi.
Here.
Hi. Great to be here. Thank you.
Good. And yeah, there's plenty of little ideas to riff off from the stuff you said in that panel just then, Richard. But maybe kick us off. Just give us a quick sense of your role and maybe just take a bit of context for listeners.
Sure. So I'm the CIO at LPPI. We're a £20 billion asset manager, investment manager. We look after the assets of three local government pension schemes, and we've been operating for just over 7 years. The role that I undertake, I'm the CIO. And to be honest, my job's a fairly standard job definition. I'm responsible for managing the team and the portfolio. We've got a team of 55. I've got a team of 55 investment professionals now, and also look after the client service activity.
That's actually quite a big team. Has it always been that size?
No, we've grown. So when I joined 6 years ago, we probably had 10, 15 people, which were essentially formed from two LGPS pension schemes, bringing them together. And then we've gradually built the team up. So it's grown significantly in the last couple of years.
Brilliant. And we always like to get the fun fact in there. So can you tell us something that we may not be able to find from your CV?
Definitely. So as I noted earlier, I had to do this at a conference recently. So I've got one lined up. So what I'd like to say is I think I peaked in terms of most performance characteristics age 11. At 11 years old, I was playing rugby for the county. I was county athletics champion. And most importantly, I won the county road safety championship. And it's pretty much been downhill since in terms of achievement since then.
County road safety
that
championship?
That just sounds so glamorous.
Yeah, it was exactly. That was the highlight.
Yeah, okay, well, there we go. That's a peak, isn't it? There's lots of discussions of peaks, but that's a peak. Okay, cool. All right, well, let's pivot to pensions and stuff then. And yeah, I guess that, I mean, the panel was interesting because it sort of got to one of the themes of the whole conference, really, which is the difference between, you know, you've got the DB pensions, you've got DC pensions, you've got local government pensions. Those are sort of emerging as the kind of three big pillars of the pension system, right? All going in like really different directions. I don't know if you've got any reflections on that. That's consistent with what you sort of...
Yeah, absolutely. And I suspect the panel was put together that way to look with people with different perspectives. When we did the pre-panel chat, it became so clear that there were very different views. And I think as I highlighted that when I first joined, I was expecting to be looking at portfolios that probably look more like what people expect from DB pensions. And when I started looking at the portfolios, a lot of LGPS pensions, they look more like what I would classify as endowments. They are genuine growth portfolios. And the mentality that you're thinking about is different. You've got both the combination of the complexity of thinking about a DB type structure in terms of the liability profile and all of that, plus that long-term perspective, and then linked to the, how do I put it, the working as part of a pillar of the state, essentially. So dealing with that, some of the complexities and benefits that brings.
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite a different dynamic, I guess, being part of the state and also that really, really long-term time horizon. I mean, one of the things, I was scribbling down some notes while you were talking.
Yeah, you're a massive note taker, right? You've done a whole notebook already.
I'm a big note taking girl. But one of the things I wrote down was the point you made about how the next couple of decades are likely to be very different to the last couple of decades. And we really need to change the way we think about risk, and perhaps just focusing on a bar metric isn't the right number. So I wonder if you could talk a bit more about that.
Yeah, I think to my mind, it just feels that you've got to keep checking yourself that what is changing, and it's the underlying assumptions that everyone just assumes that kill you sometimes, and you assume that it's always been so. I think it's a great Mark Twain quote. What is it? It's going to take me a moment to get this right now, but it's something along the lines of something that you think is so that just ain't so, or words to that effect.
And I think it's something like, it's not what you don't know that kills you, it's what you think is true but just ain't so. Yeah, what's what you're sure is true but just ain't so. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's that, and it keeps checking, because it feels to me like, you know, we all call paradigm shifts and things are changing, but it just feels the number of things are in play now that haven't been in play for a long time. And, you know, the panel was a bit shorter, so to elaborate a little bit more, what I mean by that is, you could largely rely on falling inflation, falling rates, global cooperation, globalization, a whole series of things that have made, essentially underpinned, laissez-faire capitalism, the Washington Consensus, for a long period of time. And you can argue about, when did this start? Was this post-Vietnam? Was it when the Berlin Wall fell? Was it China's ascension to the WTO? When was that, 2002? There's different views, but the start point in some ways doesn't really matter. I think what's more important is that I think some of that is changing, and the dynamics of the world power bases are shifting as well. You know, the geopolitics, clearly there are now, the superpowers of today are very different to the superpowers of the last period. You know, there's clearly a competitive point, China and the US. And I think that is playing out very clearly. These are fairly consensus views now. And I think that does change a number of the core investment thesis, because some of the global rules are being rewritten potentially. And some of this could be positive, some of this could be negative, but it just feels that we are in a, call it a cooperation recession, in terms of there is less cooperation and the power blocks are going in potentially different directions. I think there is some elements that are potentially more similar, dare I say it, that it does feel like a lot of the world is becoming more statist, you know, as I say, less laissez-faire capitalist, if that makes sense. So some of the conversation on the panels, whether it is more state intervention in terms of directing capital, I don't think that's just a British thing. I think that's much of a part of a more global perspective. And I kind of think that's likely to continue, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a fascinating point, isn't it? Because geopolitics is kind of, you know, it's always on there on the risk radars, isn't it? It always comes up in these kind of sessions. And I always think it's just such a hard thing to react to as an investor, as someone who's looking at the investment portfolio, because I always feel like guessing geopolitics is just not very well rewarded. And I don't think many people are good at it and can't guess which way things are going to go, even though they're getting all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, it's an impossible question, really. But do you have any reflections on how one does try and react to that landscape a little bit as an allocator?
So I fully agree with what you're saying, Dan, in the sense that I think trying to affirmatively bet on the positive outcome is really difficult. But where I think you've got a bit more hope, potentially, of getting into that 51-49 trade-off that we live for as investors is in terms of some of the downside risk scenarios. So you can say, in this scenario, what could go wrong? So I think what I've talked to the team about is to say, well, what I don't want to be doing is looking back in 3 years' time at things that have gone wrong on things that today were sort of knowable, that you could have worked them out. That, you know, many of the things we're talking about are unknowable. And I think there are some things you can look at from the geopolitical perspective where you think the probability of that being a problem in the future is now a lot higher than it was 3 or 4 years ago. And that is linked back to the different way that certain regimes are moving and the sort of what I would call the tectonic plates of the globe are moving. And you're seeing it in the way that different power blocks are, say, are behaving and interacting or not interacting, if that makes
sense.
And
how do you actually build that into your kind of day-to-day practical risk management at LPP? Yes, you know, is it scenario
built
analysis?
Into your VAR model, right?
Well, exactly. But it's not in a VAR model, is it? But it's more asking the question. So as a simple example, you know, something I would just challenge the equity team, our equities team on, is how exposed are we to globalization? Because it's been a long period of, you know, the global mega caps that have been able to do business everywhere in the world have dominated. And they have significant businesses, very significant businesses, in places that might not be so friendly in the future. How exposed are we to that? What does it mean? And how could that play out? And again, you're probably not going to change what you own today, but at least running those thought experiments about what does the world look like if we do move into a more fragmented view of the world? How does that play out? What natural resources are these businesses relying on? Where are they located? How might that play out?
Yeah, I mean, you touched on that a bit in the panel as well, and it's really interesting to hear your views on that. I don't think I've really heard many people talking about deglobalization yet. I'm not sure if you have, Dan, but I'd be keen to get more of your views on if that's something that's already happening and why that is.
If you talk to people, you know, say you look at the data today, there's small changes, but nothing huge. But to me, it's more when you start challenging yourself, thinking about what have we learned post-COVID, that long, ultra-efficient supply chains where it's been about minimum cost may not be so sensible in the future when you think about the sort of the energy backdrop and how do you ship stuff around the world and that activity. And then you think about technological evolution, distributed manufacturing, localization. This is stuff I was starting to look at 20, 25 years ago in university, but then it was a sort of different agenda. But you can now see, is it plausible that with additive manufacturing, you could create local manufacturing hubs? You don't need to ship stuff around the world. Does your supply chain become more stable, resilient? And I think the challenge where I'm sort of, as I say, coming at this from is to think, well, if you think about the different views of what we're dealing with, if you think you take the, dare I say it, the more right-wing, the right-wing security hawk perspective of a more muscular stance, let's say, internationally, that would suggest a more domestic focus. That's more, you know, you've seen that play out more in the US, but it's still relevant in the UK and Europe. And then you layer that against what you might call the more classical left-wing perspective of creating good jobs, employment, domestic focus, a good economy that's stable and inclusive. Actually, if you add that up and then you layer on top some of the technological advancement, energy security, you keep coming back to a more domestic focus as being potentially one avenue where that could play out. So I think it makes sense to explore that.
Yeah, it was really interesting because there's obviously been a lot of chat today generally about the kind of just schemes investing in the UK narrative. It seems to be a big question. And when you made that point, that's kind of the first time I've heard someone sort of link that to deglobalization. But that's effectively what you're saying, isn't it? It sort of puts that on the table a bit more as an angle there, which I do think is pretty interesting, actually.
It's completely explicit because I think in my mind, we have fiduciary responsibility like all major investors, all pension scheme managers. And the key that you're looking for is to find things that make sense and have that tailwind from an investment perspective. But if I come back to, if I think about it from either investment drivers or a risk perspective, there are certain future risk scenarios where the risks of some assets could be impaired by changes in that, whether it's deglobalization or further fragmentation geopolitically or of the world economy. And then I think about the positive drivers and how you align that. And it'd get a more stable, more resilient portfolio. And it's just simple stuff like, you know, investing in supply chains. I'm sure, you know, it's hardly a new idea, is it? It's just owning warehouses in the UK because of increased logistics, you know, electronic commerce.
One idea that I wanted to explore a little bit that flows from some of the stuff you were saying was, and I thought a lot about this last year when the sort of guilt crisis September, October happened, right? So you get these stable features of long periods of time that then actually get really built quite deeply into the way the industry operates. So they get built into models, they get built into systems. So they just become the default way of looking at things. So whether that's sort of VAR models, whether it's even thinking about, I don't know, equities in terms of value and growth or whatever, like there are these ways of doing it. And then if you suddenly turn around and ask a different question, none of the systems that we built sort of can cope with it at all. And I think you just get anchored to looking at the world in that same way, I guess. I felt like that sort of chimed a little bit with what you were saying. Does that sort of ring?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I've had it multiple times. A simple example, when I will happily argue or debate with people, is FX hedging. So when I joined LPP 6 years ago, and I'll name check someone in a moment, I came from a absolute return, nominal risk reduction point of view. So you hedge your FX, unrewarded risk. And then I started talking to someone, Eric Lambert, who's very well known in the LGPS, who started saying to me, yeah, but you got to think about what the liabilities are and think about it from a perspective of inflation participation. And it did then link me back to some work I'd done previously, which was then thinking, in reality, FX is another risk factor. You can use it to diversify. Then you start thinking, well, as a, you know, something I love about being a sterling-based investor, you're a non-reserve currency, which means you have investment options open to you that dollar-based investors don't, i.e. owning some unhedged dollars is normally quite helpful in a long-term portfolio. And it's that kind of thinking that, but still, you talk to many people who say, hedge out the FX, it's an unrewarded risk. And then you say, well, how are you defining risk? And it's that kind of...
I think it's just so important to have that approach to just taking a step back and questioning the status quo and thinking, just because we've always done things one way or always assumed things are the way they are, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean it is true going forwards, especially when the world is changing so much.
We've got some like crazy disco lights going on in the background here or something in the exhibition hall, which is kind of fine, but we're gonna plow on with this anyway. Do you want to shout out any recommendations for series, books, podcasts, stuff you're listening to, watching at the moment, now that Succession is finished? I don't know if you're a Succession fan or not, like me.
I haven't seen Succession, I haven't watched it. But one thing I was going to say books, it's a book called Homecoming by Rana Fuhr, I think is how you pronounce the name. Interesting, it links back to some of these topics I've been talking about. It's about that deglobalization theme. So that's one certainly I'd point to. And then a lot of the other things I would point to is just interesting for this type of work. It's some of the things you've either mentioned before, Dan, or talked about, just the decision-making theory type stuff and just reminding yourself how to navigate uncertainty and keep checking yourself that you have a forecast. What are the alternative scenarios? And there's a number of things, books around that I would just point to say, I'll have to check my phone a minute to remind myself. Sorry.
We can put it in the notes, the show notes and stuff to direct listeners actually, towards just, it.
As we're editing, one thing I would add in, I listened more recently to Stress Test, Timothy Geithner's book. I don't know if you've
come across that.
He wrote it, I think, in 2013. I'm old enough to have lived through at a reasonably senior level through the crisis last time, but it was really helpful to go back and review what he wrote about the GFC as we were in the middle of the most recent banking crisis. And I think the learning point for me was just to keep reminding myself, and I got it right this term, but what I got wrong in 08 was just to keep reminding yourself when the stakes are high and it threatens a society or a government or economy, the rules can get rewritten. It's the whole, when the problem's big enough, you can change the game. And again, that's, so to me, listening through his notes on the GFC and the navigation of that, it really reminded me of the importance of understanding that systemic risk type overlay that governments have and regulators have and how they can change things. So.
Brilliant. Well, we'll definitely be checking all of those out. Thank you so much for joining us today. This was such an interesting conversation. It's given me lots of food for thought. And have you got any tips for me for the conference while I'm here? Because this is my first time ever going.
First time for me as well.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow.
So I'm probably not the right person to ask. But there seems to be a lot of people here.
Yeah, there's definitely a buzz, isn't there? Yeah.
A lot of interesting people to talk to. And a lot of people who's, you know, let's just say, you know, they've got big jobs and they've taken their time out to come here. So.
Yes. What are you looking forward to the most then?
This interview.
Brilliant. Good answer.
This podcast, I should say.
Also, okay, all right, great. Well, Richard, it's been absolutely great chatting to you. Thanks so much for your time. Thanks for coming.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, we've been having a great day here, but it's just become even better because we've now been finally joined by Mary. How are you doing, Mary?
I am not bad. Yeah, so I had a commitment earlier today, some delays on my journey up, but I am here now. I missed all the fun of day one, but what's it been like?
It's been good. It's been great. I mean, it's been packed, hasn't it? I mean, literally almost not a spare seat in that huge auditorium. People standing at the back. That was kind of one big sort of takeaway. But yeah, what do you make of the stand or the booth and everything? It's cool, right?
It's pretty awesome, okay. I'd say. It's pretty awesome. It really stands out, doesn't it? Have you had loads of comments today?
Yeah, quite a few, yeah.
We've had lots of people literally just staring into the booth like, what is going on in there? I'm very curious. It's been quite funny watching all the reactions.
Excellent, yeah, excellent.
We've got there's a sort of a disco-y kind of a thing going on at the moment outside. So I don't know if that's an appropriate kind of backdrop to be trying to do a quick fire wrap up of a day at the conference.
Yeah, one thing that has surprised me is how much of a party it seems to be here. Like, people were getting the champagne out at about 12. I was pretty nice. Surprised about that.
Well, it is the Met Gala of pensions, right?
So that is true. It is the Met Gala of, yep.
But last year, this is your first time. We've talked about that already. You must have been like a kid in a sweet store. Tell me what it's been like for you today.
I mean, I have literally been like a kid in a sweet store at the LCP stand because we've been giving out sweets and I have been eating plenty of them just to, you know, support the business.
We have those white mice, by the way. I love the little white mice. I know it's not like a refined taste, but like, goodness me, but white chocolate.
Yeah, it stands obsessed. It's a little odd. They're not amazing quality sweets or chocolates, but you seem to love them. But yeah, I've been having lots of fun walking around all the different stands. They are pretty impressive. Lots of coffee going, lots of drinks actually at lots of them. We talked about, you know, some of the laser face in the coffee and the fluffy toys that are being given out, but lots of your usual stuff like your notebooks, your pens, all that kind of thing. I'm trying to work out like how acceptable it is to go past each stand multiple times and collect lots of merch that perhaps forms like all the stocking fillers for my family at Christmas.
You joke, but that was literally my stocking fillers for years when my dad went to a conference every November. And he would also go around and say, sorry, I've actually got two children. And he did that till we were very much too old to be going around and saying, I've got two children. Can I get that merch? So yeah, it's a winner.
I mean, I have no children, but I will still be doing that. Maybe I'll just pretend.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to exploring tomorrow and picking my own choice of the best merch. But should we, I guess, move on a little bit to content? You've had a few really, really rich conversations today and obviously been to lots of the talks. What have been the sort of main themes that have come out from today's talks?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest themes that's come out today has been the one about investment in the UK. I mean, we've been seeing the government, also the opposition, talking about that a lot. It's been all over the press. And that's definitely something that was talked about. So, you know, how would we actually do it? The fact that lots of these headlines are quite vague and they don't talk about, you know, what sort of asset classes you need and how sort of the approach to that would vary across different types of investors. And a big discussion about kind of the difference between making UK investments more attractive for pension schemes versus mandating that pension schemes have to invest in them.
Yeah. Yeah, I think my take on that would be that that's sort of been an issue that's floated around before. But this time it feels like people are actually really engaging with the question. So the fact that it's really being talked about, it is the main issue. And the fact that, you know, the reason, and then apparently the PLSA put out a report just today, actually, with 12 questions or whatever, which seems to be reasonably sensible kind of things that you'd expect them to be sort of saying about it. So it kind of has turned a bit of a corner in terms of focusing more on the practicalities of how to do it. And yeah, to my slight surprise, people seem to be engaging with the question maybe more than maybe what happened in the past. And I don't know if I detect a slight defensiveness sometimes. I feel that some of the government angle on it is sort of saying the problem is a lack of risk taking appetite among pension funds, saying you pension schemes overall are too risk averse. And I don't know, I always react a little bit defensively to that. I think that's quite fair.
Yeah, and I suppose it's what type of risk are you taking? Is it an investment risk? Is it a new idea risk? Is it both? Which I guess varies by asset class. And I suppose different types of investors that PLSA represent will probably have different views on that as well. Has that been coming out as a key theme?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the talks they did was the CIO's one, where they had a CIO from a DB pension scheme, a DC pension scheme, local government, and they just have such different, you know, approaches to investing because of their situations, which means that they are thinking about this in different ways.
Yeah, and as one of them said, I can't remember who it was now, but they're saying that 60% of our fund is invested in the UK because it's gilts and corporate bonds. And it's kind of easy to sort of forget that. People are focusing on the kind of more interesting venture capital or whatever, even infrastructure. But yeah, a lot of the core assets are already invested in the UK, right?
So, yeah, there was this really an interesting discussion around kind of nationalisation and if just... Does investing in gilts basically mean you're nationalising pensions because you are fully reliant on the UK government? It was quite strange.
That was slightly a weird comment. I don't think that's quite true. And the reply was the right one, I think, which was that it's who's bearing the risk is really what matters, right? Just because you're investing in gilts, I mean, it's nationalised.
Yeah, that phraseology sort of feels a bit strange to hear, I suppose.
Yeah, and there was a good comment in there. The question was dodged a little bit by Andrew Griffith, but it was a question about fiduciary duty. You know, are they you know, thinking of putting fiduciary duty on the table, and he basically just swerved it. And then the sort of obvious kind of headline would be, oh, they didn't deny. That's maybe a stretch.
Heard it here first.
Well, he just swerved it, didn't he? I don't know whether that there's anything in that or not.
Cool. Anything else coming up as a really sort of key theme?
There was an interesting point that Sirios made on our podcast earlier about the consensus is wrong. And this seems to be a theme that was coming out with the macroeconomics talk earlier, where there was discussion around the fact that kind of the central bank is not doing its job very well, and they're not thinking about things properly, and projections are wrong, and the market's aware of this, and, you know, it's pricing in one thing while the central banks are saying something else. So that was quite an interesting talk. And actually there were quite a few things in his session that I really hadn't thought about before. So we talked about the balance between sort of unemployment and inflation, and how each of them impact happiness, which is a really different way of looking at it, but I really liked that. And actually how, you know, even though the government might seem quite focusing on inflation rather than unemployment, unemployment has a much bigger impact on happiness. So I thought that was a really interesting way of looking at it.
And the happiness index and all that sort of stuff. Did it go into that sort of how you measure it?
No, well, he referred to a paper that I think might have gone down that road, but he didn't like expand loads on that particular point. But yeah, there must have been, it was sort of almost a throwaway comment, wasn't it, in the talk? But then there must have been a lot more research behind it. It was trying to quantify the relative, and I didn't even quite understand the point that was being made. Broadly, they were saying you can sort of quantify how painful inflation is versus unemployment, and there's a trade-off there that often gets skipped over because people are just sort of myopically focused on inflation and saying, you know, we must cause a recession to get inflation down, sort of thing. And his point was sort of to push back on that, basically. But yeah, I mean, he was generally pretty critical of sort of the Bank of England in a number of ways, I would say. In a couple of the points there was, he was saying that if you look at the Bank of England's fan chart on inflation forecasts, the central one has it getting well below 2% in 2025. And that the target's 2%, and his central forecast is 1% in just a couple of years. And so his point is like, they should be cutting rates, not raising them, sort of thing, which is a little bit, seems like slightly maybe extreme view, but he's making a fair point, I guess, which is, if you're looking at those longer term projections, it's slightly different perspective. And the other point he was making, which has a much more general kind of point behind it, was that just that sometimes your models are just wrong and you're still focusing on the same model. So he was talking about unemployment just not being the kind of macro indicator that it used to be in terms of the economy. And he was sort of saying it's basically uncorrelated with labor markets and economy and everything. It doesn't tell you what people think it tells you. So people look at unemployment thinking it's good, bad if it goes up, down, sideways, but that's just not a good indicator anymore, and that people are still kind of too focused on that, which I thought was a very, very nice sort of, what's the word, like analogy or, yeah, just example, just more generally, because you can think of so many examples of that, can't you, where it's like model that becomes very dearly held just sort of stops serving you.
Yeah, and I guess there's a sort of mandate, government or government body mandate on unemployment and not on happiness, which, you know, maybe we should change the question around.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely that was a theme that came up a lot, just the idea of the models that we've always had, the economic theories we've always had, the way we've always done things. We should question that and think about if they still make sense. And actually, some of the assumptions we make about things that are going to be here forever might not be correct. So really rethinking our risk models in that way, that came up a lot.
Yeah. I'm really here for that conversation, by the way, because normally those kind of economics panels, they're just much more your standard kind of, what I would call the standard kind of industry blah, blah, which is like, you know, the next 2-3 years predictions on inflation, on rates, and you're looking at who's voted what on the MPC and stuff like that. And it was a good choice, I thought, Professor Blanchflower, because whether you agree with him or not, right, he approached it from quite a different perspective, and he's quite kind of anti-establishment, and he's kind of a little bit funny as well.
He was very entertaining.
Yeah, it was entertaining. And the audience questions were on point. I mean, goodness me, they were like really, I'd really followed it.
They were really insightful, yeah.
Nice. Excellent. Okay.
And the other point, maybe you mentioned a second ago, Mary, I guess it's sort of coming out, we talked about a little bit though, is the kind of different pillars of the UK pensions sort of world. It's becoming really clear, DB, DC and local government. And there was also the question might be, well, should they just be different conferences, right? But I think it is interesting seeing them sitting next to each other, exchanging different perspectives. And I think there is something there in kind of capturing those different angles on it. And yeah, it seemed interesting. They all seemed willing to engage with other kind of sort of perspectives on the same assets and be able to get out of their own little area a little bit, which I think is always what you want at this sort of event, isn't it?
Nice. And I suppose that came up in our pre-conference episode as well, both with Laura and with Martin. So clearly a focus there.
So what are you looking forward to the most now, Mary, now that you're here?
I'm just looking forward to kind of being here. Like, the energy is so electric, and it's the end. It's already the end. Like, it's over, and it's incredible energy. It's actually really funny. The podcast booth has see-through walls, and the amount of people, even now, that kind of peer by. I think people think there's a camera. Right, just so okay. people know, there is no camera. We're not actually videoing this. So if you walk past and you peer in, apart from putting us off potentially, nothing else bad is going to happen. I've seen a couple of people shrink away thinking maybe things are being filmed.
But... I haven't seen people shrink away. I've been seeing some shameless staring. I'm loving it.
Excellent. Right.
Good. Okay. Well, yeah, should we sort of leave things there, wrap it up, and we'll see you all tomorrow morning and get back into it.
Yeah, absolutely.
See you then.
Looking forward to it.
Brilliant.
Our podcast is for information and marketing purposes only and does not constitute any form of investment or financial advice. For more information, please refer to our marketing privacy policy on the LCP website.